Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, and may it please the court. It's Seth Waxman on behalf of Monsanto. We are indeed the appellant in this case, and I would like to, I aspire to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The trial in this case never should have been held because the claims are preempted and because the causation opinions that plaintiff's experts offered did not pass a proper gatekeeping analysis under Daubert. As to the former, the claims are preempted because EPA has repeatedly found that exposure to Roundup and other glyphosate herbicides does not cause cancer in humans. It has repeatedly determined that therefore no cancer warning is appropriate, and it has repeatedly approved and therefore directed that labeling for Roundup does not contain any such warning. Over the decades, EPA's study of the carcinogenic potential of glyphosate and its formulations has been nothing short of encyclopedic. It has consistently concluded that they do not pose a risk of cancer in humans, and it has approved 45 versions of the Roundup label. Just last year, EPA notified Monsanto and other manufacturers that a warning of the kind that plaintiff seeks would be false and misleading and therefore violate federal law. As to Daubert, the district court permitted...
Before you move to Daubert, Mr. Waxman.
Yes, Judge Smith.
What do I do with this provision of the code 136AF2, which says, in no event shall registration of an article be construed as a defense for the commission of an offense under this chapter. Registration of a pesticide shall be prima facie evidence that the pesticide, its labeling and packaging comply with the registration provisions, but that's it.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I would say that this case does not involve any proceeding that Monsanto has committed an offense under this chapter. This is a civil tort suit brought under California state law, alleging a violation of the Fair Trade Practices Law and California common law. Second of all, we are not here contending that preemption exists because Roundup was registered by the EPA. Preemption follows here, express preemption follows from the precise language of what is called the Uniformity Clause, that is 136VB. Which says that states may not impose requirements for labeling or packaging in addition to or different from those required under this subchapter. Now, there is no question in this case that the EPA has, having determined that glyphosate and Roundup and other glyphosate formulations do not cause cancer, it has required.
But on the other hand, it seems to me, if you're going to go in that direction, don't we look at Bates versus Dow AgroSciences, which says, yes, what you've suggested, that the packaging or labeling requirement that is in addition to or different from those required under FIFRA, they cannot impose such a requirement. But it also says that the requirement need not be phrased in identical language. And it also says that it's equivalent to and fully consistent with if both impose parallel requirements, meaning that a violation of the state law is also a violation of FIFRA. So it seems to me that the argument is there is nothing which California has done which is not fully consistent with the requirements of FIFRA.
So, Your Honor, I guess I have several things to say about Bates, but directly to your point, the judgment in this case imposes a labeling requirement on Monsanto. It finds Monsanto liable for not including a warning that the EPA has determined is false and misleading. And Monsanto is prohibited as a matter of FIFRA from putting that warning on the label A without EPA's advance permission, and which EPA has already said repeatedly it would not provide. And that's the question. What Bates looks at, and if anything, Regal, the subsequent decision in Regal versus Medtronic makes absolutely clear, this was the basis, this is the only basis on which Justice Stevens separately concurred in Regal. The point is...
But the problem with Regal is that the MDA expressly preempts the claims challenging the safety and effectiveness of the medical device. And the MDA doesn't have a provision, which is like 136AF2, and that's why I put that in the record here.
So the language of the uniformity clause, which is the clause in FIFRA that relates to labeling requirements, is almost precisely identical to the medical device amendments clause. It, both of them prohibit states from imposing regulations for labeling in addition to or different from requirements that the federal agency has imposed under the relevant statute. And I think I acknowledge the premise, I think, of Your Honor's question, Judge Smith, that there is language in Bates that seems to, that could be read to suggest that when one is looking at parallel requirements, one should be looking, one perhaps could be looking at the broad language at a high, at a very high level, the language of state law versus federal law. Now, we know for a fact that that cannot be true, because that would mean that if California simply adopted by incorporation or adopted in hec verba the language of FIFRA as a matter of state law, that it could require Monsanto to use a label that is different from the one that the EPA has determined Monsanto must use. And I think the best evidence of that, Judge Smith, is in the court's discussion of the, you know, after saying, reiterating several times that any state law or rule that imposes a different or broader labeling obligation is preempted, it gave a very specific example. It said, therefore, if a state cannot hold a manufacturer be liable for a warning label that says, quote, warning rather, or caution rather than warning, when the EPA has mandated that the appropriate level of warning is caution. And it seems to me that that demonstrates that the correct level of requirement that one has to look at in order to ensure that there is in fact uniformity, as the subsection suggests, is what requirement, what has EPA looked at, what has it determined, and what requirement, labeling requirement, has it placed on the manufacturer? And
can here, I ask about, yes, Mr. Judge Nelson. Can I ask about the 2009 letter, or excuse me, the 2019 letter that EPA?
Yes, Your Honor.
Two questions. Number one, to what extent can we even consider that because of the timing of it? Meaning, perhaps that has some application going forward, but here you've got an issue where the Roundup, the specifically at issue, had been stopped being sold in 2012 in this case, and at that point EPA hadn't made that determination. And secondly, what do we do with it? It doesn't seem to have the binding force of law that is normally required.
Yes. So let me talk first about the timing, and I hope I won't forget to also address the binding nature of it.
I'll remind you.
As to timing, I think the relevant questions are, you know, the question may be slightly different, although I think the answer is the same with respect to express preemption and impossibility preemption. As to express preemption, I think there's an interesting logical question about why a court in determining whether Monsanto was expressly preempted from including any warning other than the warning that the EPA required it to, should take account of something that occurred after Mr. Hardiman, you know, was injured and brought suit. And all I can say here is that the Supreme Court differently. And I will point the court to the Supreme Court's decision in Merck last term, where in determining express preemption questions, it frequently looks at pronouncements by the agency that exist at the time. And that's probably because the preemption provision, the uniformity provision, is stated in the present tense. In any event, as the district court found here, otherwise found here, it wouldn't matter because there is no question that as of 2012, when Mr. Hardiman contracted NHL, the agency had determined that an appropriate label should not include a cancer warning and prohibited the company from putting it on.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because did they actually prohibit the company from putting it on? Or, I mean, basically these warning label, it's different than FDA. And I think that's one of the problems that's at issue here is that the EPA regulatory practice is not the same where FDA tells you what you have to put on the label. Here you have the company's proposal label. You don't have to have uniformity in the labels. So I'm not sure that means that they've prohibited this previously.
So with all due respect, Judge Nelson, I think, having been a veteran and a victim of both Merck and Bates in the Supreme Court, I think I can tell you pretty authoritatively that what the FDA does with respect to its labels and what the EPA does under FIFRA is the same. That is, the manufacturer must submit a registration application. The registration application has to include all sorts of tests and information, and it also must include a proposed label. And the proposed label is both in the FDA context and in the EPA context, the subject of a back and forth with the regulatory agency, with the regulatory agency ultimately concluding what label must be used. And so my assertion that in 2012, Monsanto was prohibited by federal law from putting a cancer warning on flows from, number one, the EPA's encyclopedic evaluation of the science. Number two, its determination that exposure to glyphosate and its formulations do not cause cancer in humans, and its requirement as a matter of statute and regulation that the manufacturer use only the label that is approved, except with respect to technical, non-substantive alternatives. Now, if I can just go to the implied preemption analysis and the timing, and then talk about why in any event, the August 2019 letter is binding and has the force of law. With respect to implied preemption, there is no doubt that the cases permit all evidence that is available at the time in order to evaluate whether it would have been impossible for the manufacturer to change the label without violating federal law. Now therefore at a minimum, the August 19th letter is a capstone on the agency's prior multiple determinations about the non-cancerous potential of glyphosate and its formulations. The impossibility preemption analysis question is whether a company can be liable for not doing something that it cannot do without EPA approval, and that EPA has indicated over and over again it wouldn't approve. That's the textbook case for impossibility preemption. Now, as to the binding nature in and of itself of the August 7th, 2019 letter, first of all, none of our argument depends on this being binding in and of itself, but it plainly is. The Supreme Court has indicated in Merck that whether something is binding or not is whether it has the force of law, and the force of law means that it was, quote, and I'm quoting from Merck, which itself was quoting from the City of New York versus the FCC and New York versus FERC, was it an agency action taken pursuant to congressionally delegated authority? Now here, there is no question. I mean, first of all, this letter was issued, and I'm sure Mr. Brightbill, who's representing the United States and EPA, can explain this more authoritatively than I can. But the record indicates that what happened was after Prop 65 was passed in California, a number of glyphosate-formulated manufacturers wrote to EPA and said, can we engage in defensive labeling? Can we put somewhere on the label a reference to Prop 65? There was one and perhaps two manufacturers, early applications, who were allowed to do it, but the EPA faced a whole raft of other applications, and it decided to take a substantive look at this. Having done it with respect to those pending applications and the applications it had mistakenly granted, it issued the letter pursuant to its statutory authority and mandate to enforce the misbranding prohibition under federal law. I mean, this is, I'm not arguing that the Bennett versus Speer test exactly equates with preemption, but this is a classic example of an agency doing something, faced with requests, makes a ruling and issues a notification to all manufacturers that you may not add this warning. And if you already have, you must take it off and send us copies of the label that you are now going to revert to.
Is that inconsistent? Would we, if we followed that argument, would we be issuing a ruling that would be inconsistent with Fellner from the Third Circuit? Fellner and the Third Circuit suggested that these informal letters that don't go through the adjudicatory process or rulemaking process don't have the force of law.
Before I answer the question, can I just, I note I only have 3 minutes left on
my
clock.
You know what, I think we're going to give you some time because I have some questions about the
IRS. Okay, yeah. I just didn't want to lose it by default.
I understand. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't think that Fellner counsels a different result here. There is no question. I mean, there is I have argued three final agency action cases just since COVID started involving letters and in one case an email from the agency. And there is no question that there are some forms of informal communication that don't have the force of law. And, you know, this court has previously in I think one or two cases whose names I have forgotten, concluded that it didn't have the binding force of law because the agency wasn't acting pursuant to its authority and its mandate. The question, there is certainly nothing about the fact that an agency determination is issued by letter that precludes it from having the force of law. I mean, in Merck itself, the Supreme Court's decision last term in Merck, it gave examples of the kinds of things that have the force of law because they were taken pursuant to congressionally delegated authority. And one of them is a letter to the registrant. And so there's no categorical prohibition. The question of whether it has the force of law is the substantive question of whether it represents the agency's genuine and non-tentative conclusion, whether it has legal and real world consequences for the regulated entities, and whether in doing so, the agency was acting pursuant to congressionally delegated authority. And here I submit there's not even an argument that that's not true.
Can we talk a little bit? Our questions, Mr. Waxman, have taken you away. You said you were also going to talk about Daubert and the expert testimony. I just have one question about that, and that is, did the district court apply a different standard under Daubert for your experts, your clients' experts, as they did for the plaintiffs' experts?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The question in the Daubert case, of course, was whether their experts offered sufficiently reliable conclusions that they passed the gatekeeping standard. And the district court was refreshingly candid about how it evaluated that standard. If I can direct the court to pages 36 and 37 of the excerpts of record, here is what, I mean, there are several instances, but here's the best instance of how Judge Chhabria perceived the relevant Daubert gatekeeping test in this circuit. He said, and I'm quoting, under a strict interpretation of Daubert, the expert's inability to differentiate those who developed NHL because of exposure to Roundup from those who would have developed it anyway perhaps would be the end of the line, at least without much stronger epidemiological evidence. But in the Ninth Circuit, that is clearly not the case. District courts in this circuit must be more tolerant of borderline expert opinions than in other circuits. District judges must account for the fact that the Ninth Circuit permits a wider range of expert opinions, arguably much wider than other circuits. That is the standard he applied to our Daubert challenge to their expert testimony.
And so, Mr. Waxman, can I ask you on that? Because I agree with you, and I have some concern about some of the Ninth Circuit case law. But what can we as a panel do about that? Because if you take the district court at face value, then we have no choice, it seems to me, under an abuse of discretion standard, particularly of affirming the district court. And I mean, I don't see a way. It's a pretty tight minefield here for you. And I'd be interested in how you're going to, you know, get through that and say we can, given the current layout in Ninth Circuit law, Merck and the other cases, Merrill and the other cases, how do we get there?
So Your Honor, I think at a minimum, this court needs to state quite clearly that it has not diverged from all the other circuits in the Daubert standard that is applied. I mean, I think this court's en banc opinion in the Baraban case and in Daubert too, that is Daubert after remand, this court made clear that the gatekeeping function is a real one and that courts cannot allow unreliable irrelevant or unreliable testimony to go to the jury on a theory that, well, cross-examination can handle this. So I think in the first instance, it's terribly important for this court to unequivocally disabuse district courts who may think that the Daubert standard is different here than in other circuits. As to why reversal is required, there's a lot can be said about Daubert, about this, the testimony in this case, but let me just focus the court's attention on the expert testimony on specific causation. That is not whether in principle, in general, there is some association between glyphosate exposure or Roundup exposure and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but whether an expert can properly opine that it was more likely than not that Mr. Hardiman's cancer was the result of his exposure to glyphosate. Mr. Hardiman offered one expert witness, Dr. Weisenberger, on specific causation. I want to talk about the failing of that witness and why it fails the gatekeeping standard and how, in light of that, the district court could have concluded that it passed the gatekeeping standard. That witness, Dr. Weisenberger, said that he was able to, the major problem in this case is that 70 or more percent of all NHL cases are idiopathic. That is, they occur.
And I wanted to address that specifically because isn't that the same thing we had in Wendell? And that's why I'm struggling. And so, I mean, if we take Wendell and Messick, that was a case where the district court excluded the evidence below. And they were reversed by our court on, you know, under abuse of discretion standard. And so it strikes me that, you know, we've got a lot of cases where the district courts exclude and then get reversed. And I'm sympathetic to the district court here who said, you know, I've learned my lesson. We like district courts who learn the lesson. And whether we've gotten it right or not before, he seems to have done the right thing here.
So let me address Wendell, which was a case in which 70 plus percent of the cases were idiopathic, just like here, and then explain why the district court erred in permitting Dr. Weisenberger to offer his specific causation testimony. We are on all fours with Wendell. There's no question that in evaluating the reliability of an expert's testimony, the court has to take account of diseases that are not well studied and diseases that are in fact well studied. In Wendell, the disease was so rare that there were fewer than 200 cases worldwide. The expert in the case had diagnosed the had both diagnosed and treated more patients with this disease than 99% of all oncologists. He testified consistent with, and this is very, very important, Judge Nelson, and it's true also of Messick. He testified that consistent with the published literature, which was that the plaintiff's exposure to the chemicals administered in Wendell made it between 3 and 270 times more likely that the plaintiff would actually fall to this particular very rare disease, and that opinion, and I'm quoting this court's opinion in Wendell, was accepted by, quote, the entire medical community. Now here we have a case in which the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Weisenberger, conceded, number one, that Mr. Hardiman could have developed cancer without exposure to glyphosate. And in fact, in his opinion, the amount of exposure sufficient to make glyphosate the cause of Mr. Hardiman's cancer was a, quote, subjective decision. Unlike in Wendell, where the disease was incredibly rare and therefore only lightly studied, glyphosate is the most studied and evaluated pesticide in history. The EPA's website lists, and it has considered, 4,200 studies and references to glyphosate and cancer. And the fact that Dr. Weisenberger also testified that he could not identify any, not one, peer-reviewed published article saying that it was generally accepted that glyphosate causes his type of cancer. And he acknowledged that he had never before in his clinical practice ever identified glyphosate as a cause of a patient's cancer. Now, what he said,
counsel, as a result of that, I think you're describing the cross examination, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, as a result of that, the jury could have disregarded that expert's testimony. Right?
That is always the case, Judge Hawkins. But I'm talking here about cross examination at the Daubert hearing. And whether or not, in light of all those facts, I was addressing Judge Nelson's question about why isn't this, do you have a, it doesn't Wendell state the state of the circuit law and why it didn't and what the difference was. I do want to go to, because I take your Honor's question to be quite correctly, whether or not we have carried our burden in showing that his testimony was so unreliable that it should not have gone to the jury under the gatekeeping function. And I want to make two points. He testified that he was able to rule out idiopathy, to basically find that it was, notwithstanding 70%+ of the cases are undiagnosable, there's no etiology, that Roundup was more likely than not, the cause of Mr. Hardiman's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, pointing to the high level of exposure that Mr. Hardiman had over the years. Number one, the district judge found as fact that Dr. Weisenberger was making his calculations based on an estimate of exposure that exceeded Mr. Hardiman's own testimony about his exposure. Number two, in calling this high exposure, he pointed to two studies, the Erickson study in Sweden and the McDuffie study from Canada. In neither of those studies, when account was taken of other pesticides the subjects were exposed to, was there any statistically significant association between exposure to Roundup and otherwise? And Dr. Weisenberger entirely failed to account for that fact and for the many, many, many other studies that showed no association. Now, the district judge understood. Oh, he also said that Mr. Hardiman's exposure was beyond the exposures of those studied in the two studies, Erickson and McDuffie, that he relied on. The district judge elsewhere found that that was not true. The level of Mr. Hardiman's exposure was in the heartland of the exposures of those subjects that had been studied in McDuffie and Erickson. So how could the district judge, having found that Dr. Weisenberger's predicates for his opinion were not supported, how could he have found that the testimony should be admitted? He did so by stating that there are different ways, you know, the fact that a disease is overwhelmingly idiopathic doesn't defeat the ability to demonstrate specific causation. In this case, idiopathy was overcome because of the, quote, robust association between exposure to glyphosate and the development of cancer or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That was that determination. That was the basis for his ruling that Mr. Hardiman's expert had barely skated over the line of a reduced Daubert test. And the language I quoted you from pages 36 and 37 do relate to his determination on specific causation. What he had previously said, first of all, elsewhere in his specific causation opinion, was that the level of association, what he called weak and too equivocal, between exposure to glyphosate and the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in general. In other words, the determination that he made at the general causation phase, which he said was so weak that under a strict interpretation of Daubert wouldn't even have satisfied general causation. He then said in his general causation opinion, given how close the question is at the general causation phase, the plaintiff appears to face a daunting challenge at specific causation phase. But he issued a brief opinion on specific causation that relied on a conclusion about the robustness of the general association between exposure to glyphosate and the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that was directly contrary to what he had found in his general causation opinion. That was error. That was an abuse of discretion. And he made no secrets about the fact that if he had misapprehended the rigor of the gatekeeping function that the Ninth Circuit applies, he would have decided the case, the Daubert questions, otherwise.
Well, thank you, Mr. Waxman.
Sorry for droning on.
No, look, we knew coming in it was going to be a complicated case. Unless there's other questions, we'll give you a little bit of time on rebuttal, and we'll still give 5 minutes to Mr. Brightville.
Thanks, Your Honor.
And thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jonathan Brightville from the Environment and Natural Resources Division on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, this is really the textbook case of what Congress intended to preempt, and the Supreme Court identified as a clear example of what is preempted by FIFRA's prohibition of state law requirements for labeling or packaging in addition to or different from those required by EPA.
I'm sort of surprised that you can say it's a textbook case when, and Judge Smith already walked through some of this. Bates was, I mean, effectively a unanimous opinion rejecting preemption. And it just seems to me that FIFRA operates differently than in the FDA context where preemption is more likely found.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think you need to read deeper on Bates v. Dow, because there are really two halves of the Bates v. Dow decision. There's a first half of the decision that relates to traditional negligence claims and express warranty claims. And then there's a second half of the decision that relates to failure to warn claims, Your Honor. And recall, in the second half of the decision, the Supreme Court doesn't say that there is no preemption. It actually remands back to the Fifth Circuit after articulating a test of sorts. Now, it's not the clearest of all decisions in and of itself, but there really is a two-part test that's articulated in the Bates v. Dow decision at 453. And when they're providing the instructions on remand, it says, quote, we emphasize that a state law labeling requirement must in fact be equivalent to a requirement under FIFRA in order to survive preemption. One, and this is really element one of the test. For example, for the Court of Appeals to determine that the element of falsity in Texas common law definition of fraud imposed a broader obligation than FIFRA's requirement that labels not contain false or misleading statements, that state law cause of action would be preempted. Now, they want you to stop there, but the Supreme Court goes on and makes clear that the actual requirement that is being articulated as a function of the state law duty failure to warn is also critical to the analysis, because the court goes on to say, and this is really element two, state law requirements must also be measured against any relevant EPA regulations that give content to FIFRA's misbranding standards. And they give the example of, quote, a failure to warn claim alleging that a given pesticide's label should have stated danger instead of the more subdued caution would be preempted because it is inconsistent with 40 CFR 156.64. And that's exactly what we have here, Your Honor, is what that portion of the regulations do in 40 CFR 156.64 do is they articulate various tiers of warning that EPA is going to then associate with FIFRA labels. And what happened here, what happens in the context of a FIFRA registration is an application comes in, it's reviewed, and a determination is made as to what level of toxicity is supposed to be associated with a given label under 40 CFR 156.64. Toxicity category one, danger. Toxicity category two, warning. Toxicity category three, caution. Toxicity category four, no signal word whatsoever. And what happened here is that the EPA has determined that there is actually no signal word that's supposed to be, this is actually toxicity four with respect to any potential cancerous implications of glyphosate, Your Honor. There is an actual caution warning on the label that comes by virtue of other toxicity implications from more acute, like if you drink it, Your Honor.
Those I think Judge Hawkins has a question.
Yes. No, counsel, pardon me for interrupting you, but I noticed that the clock is like set at 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, I think
like
they
that.
Said it wrong. I think we've got another minute here for Mr. Brightbill, and then we'll turn over to Mr. Wolf. Okay.
So what's critical to understand, though, is that under 156.64B, it's a regulatory requirement. In no case may a product, one, bear a signal word reflecting a higher toxicity category than indicated by the route of exposure of highest toxicity determined by EPA. B3, in no case may a product bear different signal words on different parts of the label. And that is what you have here, Your Honor, because what the theory of Mr. Hardiman was from his complaint all the way through his counsel's closing statement at closing argument was that the label should have had a warning about the cancerous implications of glyphosate, Your Honor. A warning, a signal word, so to speak, Your Honor, that EPA has determined is not appropriate, and it actually would violate and does violate the EPA regulations, as well as the registration determination, to have that on the label, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Brightbill. Appreciate your argument. And we'll turn now to Mr. Wool. And let's put 20 minutes on the clock. And I'm sure we went over, so we're not going to be beholden to it. But we'll have 20 minutes for both the California and Hardiman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court.
Before he goes forward, is it a problem that we can't see Mr. Waxman?
I am assuming Mr. Waxman's just turned his camera off.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So I'm just trying to make sure we have
he's still with us.
He's here.
Right.
I didn't see quite as a big a deal when the government was arguing, but I do see it quite a big deal if Mr. Wolf is arguing.
May it please the court. David Wool on behalf of Edwin Hardiman. Monsanto's theory of the case is that EPA's approval of Roundup's label and a letter that was issued that was not issued pursuant to any statutory authority preempt Hardiman's common law claims. Under Bates versus Dow and the plain text of FIFRA, this cannot be the case. I'd like to start with one overarching point that I hope will simplify the court's analysis, which is that this case is not about glyphosate by itself. This case is and always has been about Roundup as formulated, which contains an active ingredient of glyphosate, along with surfactants that allow glyphosate to stick to and penetrate the surface of plants and make it more toxic when humans are exposed.
Now, doesn't that actually hurt your argument, though? Because, I mean, seems to me that all of the evidence here concerns glyphosate. Everything else that you're talking about, surfactants, was that actually included or in the expert reports?
That was, Your Honor. And let me kind of go over the categories of expert testimony that was introduced at trial. So the experts testified about epidemiological studies that involve formulated Roundup. They testified about toxicology studies that involve only the active ingredient glyphosate, and then cell studies that evaluate the mechanism by which glyphosate or Roundup interact with human cells and can cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so the cell studies give us an opportunity to evaluate Roundup versus glyphosate and measure the relative toxicity of each. And so I don't think it was the case that all of the evidence was only about glyphosate and not Roundup. And in addition to the scientific evidence, we introduced a plethora of circumstantial evidence and evidence from Monsanto's employees and scientists that repeatedly remarked that glyphosate and Roundup are not the same, that the formulation is what does the damage, and that sort of thing. So I don't think it's the case that that the evidence was only about glyphosate at trial.
Can I, you made a statement that struck me. You said that the EPA's 2019 letter was not issued pursuant to statutory authority. That strikes me as a bit broad, perhaps an overstatement, and one I don't know that you need to win your case. I mean, the question is whether it has force of law, but I'd be interested if you want to develop that argument about why there was no statutory authority for the letter.
Of course, Your Honor. So, and this is in the United States brief at page 4. When EPA is either going to reject a label or exercise its misbranding authority, there are a precise set of procedures that EPA must follow. And this is also described in the Reckitt case, which is at page 51, I believe, of our brief. And in this instance, this letter that EPA sent to registrants does not purport to exercise any of that authority. It doesn't follow the prescribed time periods. And just to give you an example, if EPA is going to formally reject a proposed label change, it has to send the manufacturer a letter. It has to publish notice in the Federal Register. And none of that has happened here. And so this is the type of action that that in Merck, the Supreme Court described as not being issued pursuant to any statutory authority. It's merely an agency musing.
Well, but you said that they have to issue a letter. This, perhaps the better way to say it is this is the beginning of the statutory authority, but they didn't publish it in the Federal Register.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Even if it was the beginning of that process, this letter doesn't follow the time periods that are delineated by FIFRA for either the rejection of an EPA label or to exercise misbranding authority. So I think it would be a little bit of a stretch to argue that this is the formal beginning of either of those processes.
But, okay, let's assume that you're correct, that for whatever reason the letter doesn't have the force of law. What deference would be due to it? If we took the position that this was just the agency's position on how far the labels could go, but that it didn't have the force of law, would it still be entitled to our deference?
Well, here we know from Merck that where an agency doesn't act pursuant to its statutorily delegated authority, that it can't preempt. And so regardless of the level of of deference that we give the letter here, this isn't something that can have preemptive force at all. And even if it could have preemptive force, I would point your honor to page 2 of the letter, which says that that EPA would reject label changes or ask registrants to change the warning on either the only basis being that it has glyphosate in it or the exclusive basis of the change, of the warning being that the label has, or the product, I should say, has glyphosate in it. And that's not our case here. That was not the exclusive basis for Hardeman's claim. So even if we said the letter had force of law, it couldn't have preemptive force in this context.
Well, but Prop 65 dealt with glyphosate. I mean, that was the specific issue. That's what they were addressing. You're suggesting that they may still have had to put on the warning label separate and apart from glyphosate because of the surfactants?
Yes. Well, our claim, what the jury was asked to decide in this case was whether Roundup caused Mr. Hardeman's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There was nothing about whether glyphosate by itself would do so. I don't think that on that basis, even if the letter had force of law, that it could have force of law in this context to preempt Mr. Hardeman's claim, if that answers your honor's question.
Counselor, I would like you to focus on the government's last argument. Taking Bates and taking the language therein and their last arguments that they made here today.
The argument about regulations, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, so I think that the government's argument actually highlights why there can't be preemption in this context. The regulation that the government pointed to deals with warnings for acute hazards from exposure. So for example, a single isolated exposure and the warning that would correlate with that. The fact that that EPA has decided to promulgate a regulation that can't have force of law for acute exposures, but not chronic exposures, which is what we are dealing with in this case, shows that we cannot have preemption here. And I would also just point out to the court that what that regulation deals with is the caution words that must accompany specific categories of pesticides for acute exposures. And so while, for example, a pesticide being correctly categorized as something that might not be preempted, we would agree that if a plaintiff's claim challenged the specific warning that accompanied that acute exposure and not whether the claim was correctly categorized, that would be preempted, if that answers your honor's question.
Well, I just wanted your response. I have outlined what I thought your response. I just want to make sure where you were going.
Right. And to be clear, we would agree that a regulation promulgated with a notice and comment period, can have the power to preempt, but there is no such regulation here. And it's notable that neither Monsanto nor the government points to one.
What do you make of Mr. Waxman's argument that Monsanto and other chemical producing companies asked for permission to change their label in light of the California proposition?
Well, I think if we look at the government's brief, what the government says there is that that some registrants were granted permission to make this change. But I think that the issue here under FIFRA, we know from 136 AF2 that the burden is always on the manufacturer to make sure that its label is adequate. It's not sufficient to just turn things over to EPA and say, do what you want. The manufacturer has the ability to propose a label change and is at all times required to make sure its label is adequate. And so here on this record, we don't know if, we know Monsanto has never proposed a label change, but we...
I think you may have answered my question, but you're telling us that the record does not reflect one way or another whether Monsanto asked to change its label in light of the California proposition. Is that correct?
Well, At trial, we actually, I believe we introduced evidence to show that Monsanto had never made such a request. So it's not just one way or the other. We know that Monsanto did not ask.
Well, that was a trial, but what I thought, maybe I'm misunderstanding. I thought Judge Hawkins was asking that led up to the 2019 letter or after Prop 65.
Right. There's nothing in the record that to show that Monsanto ever requested that label change and that the label change was rejected. And I think that's important because it's when a registrant does propose a label and the government rejects it, that's not the end of the line. There's a whole process that follows that rejection, and none of that's happened here.
So can I just, I know here we're talking about whether there's the force of law in a labeling related decision. We've talked about the informal letter, if you will, from 2019. We've talked about some of the other decisions that they've made. Is your position that just under this regulatory regime, EPA labeling related decisions would never have the force of law, or is there some example where they would have the force of law?
Well, under our broadest theory, because of 136AF2 and the fact that the duty is always on the manufacturer, we would say that there's never a circumstance where the EPA's mere rejection of a label could have the force of law. More narrowly, perhaps Monsanto could argue that if it went through the process of proposing an adequate label that EPA subsequently rejected, then perhaps that could have the force of law and could create a preemptive requirement. But again, that's not the case that we are dealing with here.
Well, but isn't that sort of what happened with the informal letter? They came and said, you know, we want to add this preemptive a warning, and it was effectively rejected by EPA. So why, under what you just said, why wouldn't that then have the force of law?
Well, my point was that if a manufacturer went through the entire process that's mandated by FIFRA and that resulted in a denial of a label, then perhaps under a more narrow theory, that could have the force of law, but that is not what happened here.
But it seems to me that the history here is that after the resolution was passed, there were certain companies which applied and were granted a different label with cancer warning, and Monsanto wasn't necessarily one of them. But then there came a different time period where the EPA rejected all of those warnings and said, no, you're not going to put those on. Monsanto wasn't necessarily a part of those. And then they came out with the August 7th, 2019 letter. And I guess my worry is you're suggesting that none of this has the force of law.
Well, again, Your Honor, no adequate label change has been formally rejected. What we have here in the form of this letter is simply an agency musing that cannot have preemptive force.
Well, you're just talking about the August 7th, 2019 letter, but wasn't there a time when the EPA rejected putting those warnings on?
Not in this record. I believe the August 2019 letter is the only thing that indicates that EPA might reject warnings. And Your Honor, I would point you to, it's on page 10 of our brief, but the only registration decision that was operative at the time of Hardeman's exposure to Roundup is the 1991 registration decision that cautioned that it was based on information that was available at the time and would be subject to change if there was new information. And so I don't think that we can look at any registration decision and say that it conclusively establishes that the EPA would not have approved an adequate warning had it been proposed by a registrant. And so I would like to, if I may, if there are no more questions on preemption, turn to the Daubert arguments that my colleague, Mr. Waxman, made. Mr. Waxman's argument focused on basically what was amusing by the district court about what might happen in another circuit. And specifically, the line that he referenced was that the expert's failure to point to a specific biomarker might be the end of the line for Daubert in another circuit. And I would like to point out that that the presence or absence of a biomarker is something that would establish proof tantamount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not required under this this court's Daubert law or any circuit, and accordingly, it's not something that even if the district court was right and said, you know, or if the district court had said there's no biomarker, we're going to exclude the experts, that's something that would have been a clear abuse of discretion right there. The next argument that I heard
do you believe the Ninth Circuit case law interpreting Daubert and applying it is inconsistent with other circuits?
I think that the way Daubert's interpreted across circuits differs by case. I think that you could probably draw some distinction between some cases where you might say there's a more strict interpretation in certain circumstances, there's a more liberal interpretation in others. But the point of that is that I think it simply underscores that Daubert is necessarily a context and fact-specific inquiry, and that's why district courts are afforded such broad latitude, being able to immerse themselves in the science. I
agree with your statement that it does give latitude, but I am a bit concerned about whether the Ninth Circuit has departed from other circuits and whether that needs to be corrected in some way. And I'm not sure how to articulate that because, you know, that if you, to your point, like these cases are all decided on the facts of each individual case, but the trend in the Ninth Circuit particularly seems to be, you know, reversing under abuse of discretion, district courts who don't allow Daubert evidence in. And I mean, I haven't done full research to compare that, but it does seem that the Ninth Circuit has, and I can't put my arms around it yet, but has departed from some of the other circuits in how it applies Daubert.
Well, let me try to answer that question. I think that under any articulation of the Daubert standard, our case would pass muster. And I will point the court to a number of lines of evidence that were present in this case that distinguish it from, I think, every case that Monsanto cites. In this case, we had statistically significant, fully adjusted epidemiology showing an odds ratio over 2.0, which Monsanto concedes at page 52 of its brief is sufficient to infer specific causation. The experts analyzed dose response. There were animal studies, and the experts analyzed the mechanism by which Roundup causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that included human studies showing that exposure to actual Roundup formulations in the real world resulted in genotoxicity in human lymphocytes, and that's at ER 588, where Dr. Weisenberger provides that testimony. And so the upshot of this is that I believe every case that Monsanto cites trying to distinguish this court's interpretation of Daubert from some other circuit's interpretation, all of the cases where an expert was excluded turned on the absence of one of those lines of evidence, whether it's statistically significant, fully adjusted epidemiology, admissible general causation opinions. All of the cases that they rely on don't have those factors. And so, you know, I do not think that it is the case that our case would not have passed Daubert muster under another circuit.
But if the district court, let's take the reverse of that. Let's say that the Ninth Circuit is consistent with other circuits. The district court operated under the presumption, and the legal ruling seems to be based on his assumption that the Ninth Circuit is out of step. So if, in reverse, we were to say, no, the Ninth Circuit is just like other circuits, we don't have a different standard, wouldn't that suggest that the district court erred by basically saying in the Ninth Circuit, tie goes to admissibility, whereas in other circuits, you know, close cases would be excluded?
Well, under every circuit's Daubert law, Daubert is to be applied with a liberal thrust favoring admission. But let's say that the district court was wrong about whether or not there's daylight between some of this circuit's cases and other circuits, and that this circuit applies the same Daubert standard. Well, if we trace the court's analytical process in reaching either its general causation or specific causation opinion, I don't even think Monsanto is contesting that the district court followed this circuit's case law. And so if it was incorrect about whether there's daylight between certain cases in this circuit and other circuits, the opinions themselves make crystal clear that it followed this circuit's case law. And so in reaching its opinions, I don't think that there's that the question of whether there's daylight between the circuit and other circuits, you know, is really something that would.
I'm not sure that I agree with that. Doesn't Monsanto suggest that Wendell only allows experts to rely on clinical experience in exceptional circumstances, not present here, not particularly involving rare diseases with insufficient epidemiological data? Isn't that their idea? Isn't that exactly what they're saying, that we have, that the district court went further than Wendell would allow?
No, I don't think the district court went further than what Wendell
would
allow.
Well, you don't think so, but that's Monsanto's argument, even given Wendell.
So I think this is important. Here we had a considerable amount of evidence that wasn't present in Wendell. And Monsanto's argument hinges on the assumption that the evidence was favorable to Monsanto. As our experts testified at trial, it wasn't. And I'll particularly point you to Dr. Weisenberger's reliance on the NAP study, which was a study fully adjusted for other pesticides that showed a relative risk of, I believe, 2.49, which means that that somebody who was exposed to the amounts of Roundup, as those people in the study, would have had their risk of getting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma go up by approximately 150%. So it would more than double. Monsanto concedes that a relative risk over two, like we have here, is sufficient to infer specific causation. And so on the basis of that evidence, along with all of the other evidence that Dr. Weisenberger relied upon, there's clearly sufficient evidence to infer causation. And just because Wendell had less evidence doesn't mean that the standard for reliability goes up in this case.
But it seems to me that they're suggesting this is not an exceptional circumstance, which is the only place you'd get to with Wendell.
Well, I would point, Your Honor, to the Messick decision, which the district court also relied upon. And as we point out in our brief, that opinion didn't involve rare injuries at all. And nothing in the Wendell case limits its application to rare injuries. The fact that there was less evidence there doesn't create a lower bar for Daubert than in other cases. There's a single Daubert standard, which is whether the evidence is relevant and reliable.
Well, and then if we go to Messick, it seems to me that Monsanto says the district judge went over the top even on Messick, emphasizing that the expert there relied on clinical experience as well as an examination of medical literature and plaintiff's records. And I'm only reading what they said because I wrote it down. Whereas here, that didn't happen.
That's not correct, Your Honor. Dr. Weisenberger did rely on Hardiman's medical history. He examined the pathology, and he obviously relied on all of the relevant literature in reaching his causation opinions. And I would like to also point out that Dr. Weisenberger, in addition to being a pathologist at one of the foremost cancer hospitals in the world, is also an individual who had been studying the cause and effect of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma vis-a-vis pesticides for 30 years. There's probably nobody in America who's been taking a look at this question for as long and as hard as he has.
Did the district court apply a different Daubert standard to Monsanto's experts than it did to yours?
I do not think so, Your Honor. And we point out in our brief that what Monsanto's specific causation expert did in terms of her trial testimony employed what is essentially the same methodology that Hardiman's expert, Dr. Weisenberger, did, which was to evaluate Hardiman's medical history and his relevant risk factors and what her ultimate conclusion was, well, I think that hepatitis C is a sufficiently strong risk factor, then I'm going to say that was the cause of this non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And while Hardiman's experts ruled out hepatitis C, the basic methodology of saying, Roundup is a very strong risk factor. There are no other risk factors present, is a reliable basis to rule out idiopathic causes. And that's what they did here. So I think that the standard for both experts was pretty much the same.
Mr. Waxman pointed to a series of specific instances in which he argues your experts were deficient. You recall the argument?
Yes, he I believe the reference was to two epidemiological
studies. That's just an introduction to my question. So
okay, sorry.
Hang on for just a second. Were those deficiencies made apparent to the jury during the specific and general causation during phase one of the trial?
Yes, the Monsanto's cross-examination focused on for certain epidemiological studies where there was not adjustment for confounders. So that was indeed presented to the jury in their cross-examination, which is exactly what's supposed to happen under Daubert.
Okay.
We've taken you over. Everyone's gone over in this case, so that's not on you. But unless there's other questions, perhaps we can move on to California and hear from.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. It's Andy Weiner, Deputy Attorney General for the State of California. The court's proper resolution of this case is critical to California and its ability to protect the safety and well-being of its citizens. The arguments made by Monsanto in the United States regarding preemption are contrary to congressional intent and the carefully considered state-federal balance struck by FIFRA, a unique statute that preserves and, in fact, depends on a large role for state enforcement. Under this statutory framework, which Your Honor's questions reflect is clearly distinct from the MDA context, EPA's actions in this case do not have preemptive effect. With respect to EPA's actions as to glyphosate, only federal law has the power to preempt. Agency actions are only preemptive if the agency exercises authority granted by Congress. EPA has exercised no such authority that could have preemptive effect. The 2019 letter from EPA, which did not consider any particular warning label or warning language, as the agency would be required to do in a registration decision, but instead states in the abstract that the agency would consider a warning to be misbranding, is simply not federal law. Impossibility preemption is a demand.
Can I just ask you a question on the 2019 label or letter? It does seem like, I mean, clearly California has taken the position that a Prop 65 warning needs to be included on any product that has glyphosate. Is that accurate?
That is not exactly accurate. There may be products containing glyphosate that may fall within a safe harbor that would not need to have a warning under Prop 65.
But that's not likely probably to apply to a pesticide with this degree of concentration of glyphosate. Or do you think it still could?
I think it still could. I don't think that determination has been made.
Okay. So then maybe that answers my question. California has not initiated any Prop 65 prosecutions based on Prop 65 at this point.
That's correct.
Okay. And I guess if that happens, then we'll get a big, a separate case about whether that would be preempted under the EPA's current position that those warning labels can't be put on the pesticides.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to what Monsanto would do in that case. I will say...
Well, whether Monsanto... But EPA currently has taken the position that you can't put a Prop 65 warning label on these pesticides, right?
It has taken that position informally. That's correct.
Okay.
But... With respect to EPA's letter, if EPA were to actually follow the formal procedures outlined by Congress, we don't know that it would reject every possible warning statement for Roundup. And that's especially so considering that EPA has only studied glyphosate in its pure and isolated form rather than it's actually used. Congress requires EPA to follow formal processes for a reason. The procedures give interested parties the opportunity to comment and require the agency to respond in a rational way with review by a judge. EPA's letter, therefore, lacks force of law. EPA's registration of Roundup is similarly immaterial to the preemption analysis. The agency's assertion that after approval the label is the law, that's just a rhetorical sleight of hand. True, a registrant can't sell a pesticide without EPA approval. But as Judge Smith correctly observed, FIFRA expressly says that registration does not immunize the manufacturer from liability. There is no parallel provision in the MDA, and that's a critical difference in the statutory framework. Yes, EPA approval is necessary, but it's not sufficient to foreclose application of state law. Registration of a pesticide could only have preemptive effect if the court ignores the plain text of the statute, and that the court should not do. So unless there are further questions, the court should affirm the district court's well-reasoned holding that neither FIFRA nor EPA's actions related to glyphosate prevent California from imposing liability in this case.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your argument. Mr. Waxman, we'll give you, say, 3 minutes, most of what you requested for, and let's try and keep to it.
Your Honor, of course, Your Honor can cut me off whenever. I have two or three points to make in response on preemption and 2 points only to make in response to Daubert. Point number one on preemption. There is this notion that has now been advanced here that all that EPA studied was glyphosate and not the full formulation, including surfactants, is so utterly baseless. It is so utterly false that if you simply look at pages 11 and 12 of our Step 3 brief and look at the very document that my friend on the other side cited in his brief as proof of this, which is found at page Plaintiff's Further Excerpts of Record, 37 through 46. I want to quote here from their gold standard document on page 46. We've received many, many comments, concerns about the toxicity of glyphosate. Our response, all active and inert ingredients must be approved by the agency when a pesticide is first registered, including for glyphosate products. The EPA evaluates the active and inert ingredients hazard potential or toxicity with a battery of toxicity study. EPA can require that any inert ingredients of toxicological concern be listed in the ingredient statements of the label if determined to pose a hazard to humans or the environment. Monsanto itself conducted genotox studies both on Roundup and on glyphosate, submitted all of them to the EPA. None showed any association. By definition, all of the epidemiological studies that the EPA considered are all on Roundup, the formulation, not on glyphosate, because we're not injecting farmers with glyphosate. Second of all, the district judge held that the only triable issue in this case was glyphosate, because the evidence on any difference between glyphosate and Roundup was, quote, exceedingly thin and therefore, quote, insufficient for the jury to conclude that Roundup was carcinogenic while glyphosate alone is not. That's on page 15, note 3 of the excerpts of record. Secondly, what is preemptive here is the specific labeling requirement for the product. It cannot be otherwise, both because then the specific example that EPA gave of a label that that EPA says has to say caution, not warning, is incoherent. And if there were any doubt about any ambiguity in this, the Supreme Court specifically addressed this issue in this very issue in the Merck case, and it was the distinction between Justice Stevens's concurrence. You can look at footnote one of his concurrence where he says the majority has said that the specific application is preemptive, the specific requirement. I disagree with that.
We better round it up now. Let's go ahead and conclude, Mr. Waxman. Thank you.
Okay. As to Daubert, my friend on the other side has said absolutely nothing about specific causation. Everything he talked about as to the Knapp study and everything else has nothing to do with the fact that Dr. Weisenberger, under any standard, did not satisfy the Daubert test for specific causation.
Okay. Thank
Does that
you.
Wrap it up.
It does.
Thank you.
We really appreciate everybody, expert arguments from all parties in this case, and for everybody's participation. It's obviously, hard case to get your arms around, and it's been helpful today. So thank you very much. The case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're back in recess.